Welcome to Political Rewind. As I said at the very top of the show, we really are following breaking news this afternoon. Within the last couple of hours, we learned that the White House announced that Steve Bannon, the chief strategist for President Trump, who is identified with a white nationalist cause in by many other people, is definitely out at the White House. So we're going to start our conversation by talking about the implications of that. Jim Galloway, the political writer for the AJC, is here. You read him on Thursdays and Sundays in the paper, and he oversees the Political Insider blog. Just a quick preview. What are you going to write for Sunday? What are we going to read?
Rural Georgia's worst enemy.
Is? Or are you going to keep us hanging?
Their local internet provider.
Oh, interesting. Beth Shapiro is back with us. It hasn't been, we haven't seen you very recently, and it's very nice to have you back in the studio.
It's nice to see you again.
Beth, of course, is now a woman of leisure, but she's, for a long time, was a Democratic political pollster, consultant. And, you only wish? Are you working hard these days?
I have some friends who are running for office in the City of Atlanta elections this fall, and I'm helping them as best I can.
Oh, all right. Well, we'll talk about that at some point, too. Eric Tannenblatt, one of Georgia's and the Southeast best-known Republican insiders. We've said this many times. He's worked for Republican presidential candidates like George H.W. and George W. Bush, Mitt Romney. And as well as those national races, worked on races here in the state. And he, former chief of staff for Governor Sonny Perdue. That's something we don't always mention when you're here.
And I was the chief of staff when we changed the flag.
Let's talk about that a little bit today. And Michael Owens.
Again.
Yeah, again. Changed it again, right. Michael Owens is back with us. He, of course, is the chairman of the Democratic Party of Cobb County. Michael, good to have you here.
And a cybersecurity expert.
And an expert on cybersecurity.
Yeah, I dabble a bit in that as well.
Yeah, you work with, you work with the government at a pretty high level in some of the work you do, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting times, I guess is the best way to say it. And I think the confluence between geopolitical activity, shall we say, and cyber is really puts me in a unique space right now. So I'm quite busy, but I'm definitely enjoying it.
Good. Hey, while you're here, could you look at my computer? Because there seems to be some network problem that I can't figure out.
No? Oh, not a problem.
Oh, okay, good.
Maybe it's Russians. I'm going to turn my Wi-Fi off.
All right. Jim, the Bannon news, you know, I don't think any of us here in the studio or anywhere paying attention to politics is completely surprised. It appeared for a while that Bannon could be in trouble, but he has survived every previous time that everybody has said he's about to be out, not this time.
No, and I think it's I rather than Charlottesville, I think it has more to do with General John Kelly, the new chief of staff, and this fight that Bannon is supposed to have picked with H.R. McMaster's on the National Security Council. I mean, basically what this is the removal of Donald Trump's ideological marker in the White House, I think. And it's going to be interesting to see where he goes out there on his own.
Well, it's a little bit more than just that, because with the departure of Reince Priebus, who provided, I think, some comfort to the more establishment Washington types, and then Steve Bannon, who provided comfort to some of the more pro-nationalists, as you said. Now you have both of those, the individuals that both of those groups look to in the White House, now gone. And it's going to be interesting to see what happens with the Republican base right now.
Yeah, and we want to get into that. But Eric, as long as you have the floor, I did. One of the thoughts I had when I heard this news and realized that you were going to be here today was, if I were an Eric Tannenblatt Republican, I would be breathing a sigh of relief that Bannon, who is, a guy who comes in and breaks the furniture and throws dishes and does not represent the more mainstream ideals of the Republican Party, is at least out of the White House.
Look, for me, it's the president is the person who got elected by the people. And the president should seek advice and counsel from whoever he so chooses. And then he has to process whatever information, whatever advice he's getting, and be the ultimate person that makes the decision. So you can have a number of aides, advisors, strategists around you, but at the end of the day, the president's the person who calls the shots.
And that's the essential reason why nothing much will change from a public perception, because you've got a president who likes to break dishes and throw furniture, and whose true self gets revealed when he's speaking off the cuff. So I think from an ideological standpoint, not much will change with Donald Trump, the person, because we've seen this week and many times over the last year and a half what his true self is.
Yeah, I could agree with that, definitely. It's like rotating chairs, right? It doesn't matter. Whoever the chief is, whoever the commander-in-chief is, will kind of set the tone and set the stage. But it's very interesting to me with John Kelly, right? A decorated Marine Corps veteran taking the helm, right? And we all know that Trump said various different things about military generals, but as a Marine Corps general, you're going to be very strict and proper about your protocol and what's happening and the way things are happening. And the Trump whole administration has been very loose. It's been very free-flowing with information or misinformation. And someone like Kelly coming in, I mean, I can say from a Democratic standpoint, you know, hoping, just from a, I'll say outside a Democrat, just as an American, right, hoping that, you know, he is a calming voice to come in and really right the ship, if you will. In order to do that, you got to get rid of a few people.
But to Eric's point, I mean, this is kind of a first. I mean, you've got the generals now in charge of the White House, and we don't know where they are politically, really, because their job has in the past has their careers have been all about being non-political.
Correct.
Also have the generals in charge of our moral conscience, because it was the leaders of each of the branches of the military who spoke out this week about discrimination and racism when their commander-in-chief was not able to do that.
Yeah, can I
from
just,
the heart?
And they
sure.
did that. All four top military generals spoke out, right? All of them did. So you know, yeah, you can think about from a military standpoint, right, of driving what the White House should be. But the fact of the matter, they're coming out and not standing with him. I think.
Well, I think Kelly is going to, and he's already demonstrated he's bringing order to the White House. But you know, President Trump is not someone who's been involved in politics before he got elected president. And so he has to get an agenda through the legislature, through the Congress. And part of the way you get your agenda through the Congress is the support that you have from around the country from the grassroots.
All right, wait.
I thought you got it through by criticizing the leader of the Senate.
Wait, I'm sorry. I really want to go back a step because I'm a little surprised by what I heard you say, Eric. And I want to pick up on it in terms of Bannon. My suggestion that Bannon was a departure would be good for mainstream Republicans. Is this not the same Steve Bannon who earlier this week was getting a lot of the blame for the fact that President Trump chose to remain refused to condemn the white supremacists, the neo-Nazis, the Klansmen who marched in Charlottesville because Bannon's influence makes a difference there? Is it not Bannon?
Well, but Bill, Steve Bannon wasn't standing in the lobby of Trump Plaza talking to the press.
I get that.
That was the president. But the president could have gotten advice from Steve Bannon and said, thank you, Steve, but I won't do that because I want to talk about the moral compass of our country and bringing people together.
So our friend Eric Tannenblatt is telling us that rather than Bannon having resigned today, he would have preferred if it had been President
No,
Trump.
I did not say that.
I'm kidding.
No, I think what everybody can agree here now, let's just settle down, folks, settle down. I think what everybody can agree on is that Trump is president. Trump makes the calls.
Correct. Yeah.
And with or without Bannon, you still have what Donald Trump thinks.
And there's a big group of people around this country right now that are very upset by this move, that were holding on in terms of their support of the president because Steve Bannon was in the White House.
Yeah, and if you want to know how strong those voices are, go to Breitbart today, go to Breitbart News, and look at the story, the Bannon departure story, and then scroll down and look at the comments from Breitbart readers. People are really angry in that camp about his departure.
They can be angry, but I'm hoping that that is a very, very small majority of the American population, right? They may be loud, but we see Trump's support numbers continue to go down, right? The continuous revolving of staff or the lack of hiring or even having nominees for certain posts around throughout the administration. So, if this is the direction that it's going, I think those voices may be loud, but I have to believe that that is a very small population.
Well, here's one other thing that we haven't kind of acknowledged is that we don't know whether it's good or bad to have Steve Bannon on the outside of the tent looking in, or would it have been better to have him inside looking out?
Right. I mean, when Reince Priebus, right, I think Reince Priebus has handled himself very well since he left. But look at what's happening to some of the leaders on Capitol Hill. And I wouldn't lump them in the category of Steve Bannon, supporters, but some of the comments that they're making about the way the White House is handling things or the way the president is handling things.
I think one of the comments that really caught my attention was from Senator Corker of Tennessee, who is from Chattanooga, which is probably the most conservative part of a pretty conservative state. He used the word stability. He was questioning the
competence too, I think.
President's stability and competence. So when a very staunch Republican conservative starts to utter words like that, that's a little red flag, or that certainly it's a marker to look to see what other of the more common sense senators start to say, and representatives start to
say. Well, and you have Senator Tim Scott from South Carolina. You had Marco Rubio. I mean, there's a number of them. And you also had the president take shots at the Senate Majority Leader, who has to approve or lead the chamber in approving those nominees that you just referenced.
That's correct. I still think it ties back to overall, it's going to tie back to the support that Trump gets within those districts, right? So if you're looking at those congressmen and those senators specifically, what does their level of support look like for Trump? As that number starts to get lower and lower, their capacity or their willingness to speak out against Trump is going to happen.
So, you've already anticipated where I'd love this conversation to go, but let's wrap up the Bannon, and that is talking about some of the Republicans who are now speaking out critically, using Trump by name, which we will talk about in a minute. But just to finish this off, Jim, there seems to be some, we don't quite understand how this unfolded. One scenario has it that, in fact, Bannon offered his resignation on August 7th, planned on leaving then, and then Charlottesville took place, and they felt it was best to hold off. I'm not quite sure I understand why, but they did. And yet there's also some question as to whether Trump may have gone to him and said, "You're out, pal." And the reason that becomes a little bit more significant is that we are told frequently that although the president likes to attack people on Twitter and that sort of thing, he has a hard time confronting people and making tough decisions like letting somebody go.
Right. And there you also have the fact that I'm not sure how to read Bannon's interview with the American Prospect. That was
yeah, this is the,
one strange interview.
Yeah, this is the interview in which, among other things, he undermined Secretary of State Tillerson and the Defense Department in terms of the fact that we were prepared for the possibility that we would take action against North Korea if they decided to attack in some way. And Bannon essentially said, "Oh, that's nonsense. We can't do anything about them. They're holding South Korea hostage."
Well, and if the timeline is, as you described, that the letter of resignation was submitted earlier in the month, this was a parting shot. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what that was.
Okay. Is this going to make any difference on Capitol Hill in terms of how Republicans view the White House? Or is it, as Eric says, Beth, as long as Trump is in charge and not being more controlled in his messaging, it won't mean anything?
I don't think it means anything in terms of how Trump comports himself or what he says or what he thinks. I do think for those of us who were very uncomfortable with the thought of the two or three of these alt-right leaders in the White House, and Bannon being the top of the main one of those three, I think we're pleased that kind of thinking, that kind of person is at least not coming into work every day. The president still has a phone, still can communicate with people, so This doesn't say that Bannon's not communicating with him, but at least he's out of the White House and doesn't have that platform to lift him up.
Well, and as you indicated from the comments on Breitbart and some of the other comments, which I haven't seen, but if the supporters of Bannon are exercised and they let their voices be heard, it is going to impact what happens on Capitol Hill, and it's just going to create more chaos. And right now, we have too much chaos in this country, and we're craving for leadership.
This is a thank you for giving us a transition that we can make first to a break.
And happy to do it.
And then come back. You want to substitute host the show when I'm on vacation? So let's take a quick break and come back and talk about just that, where the events of this week have led the left Republicans in terms of coming back from summer break and having to start tackling a really, really daunting agenda. This is Political Rewind. We'll be right back.
Financial contributions from listeners like you are not the only gifts that keep GPB on the air. In fact, many listeners have already chosen to donate a used vehicle to GPB. We'll pick up your vehicle for free and send you the paperwork for your taxes. Get started today. Call 877-GPB-1-CAR or go to gpb.org/cars. That's 877-GPB-1-CAR or gpb.org/cars. And thanks.
Thank you for listening to Georgia Public Broadcasting. I'm Ricky Bevington. GPB Atlanta is licensed to Georgia State University, nationally recognized as a leader in innovative programs that help students earn their degrees.
Beth Shapiro, Eric Tannenblatt, Michael Owens, Jim Galloway in the studio. Eric, a number of our tweeters who tweet us at PoliticsGPB agree with you, Republicans, saying basically you're right that it's up to the president to change the tone. It isn't a question of whether Steve Bannon is in the White House or not. So that's interesting to hear those comments. Let's do this. You talked before the break, Eric. And Jim, let me start with you on this. We on this show the other day said that the Republic, you know, there are very few Republicans in Congress who have watched the way the president comported himself in response to Charlottesville, have been willing to call him out by name.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
But now it's starting. So, for instance, and we have two Southern Republican senators, which is, I think, even more interesting. One African-American, the other white. For instance, Tim Scott of South Carolina, who's been a Trump loyalist, said this just the other day.
I'm not going to defend the indefensible. I'm not here to do that. I'm here to be clear and to be concise and succinct. His comments on Monday were strong. His comments on Tuesday started erasing the comments that were strong. What we want to see from our president is clarity and moral authority, and that moral authority is compromised when Tuesday happens. There's no question about that. We should all call that on the carpet.
And then let's listen to Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee.
The president has not yet been able to demonstrate the stability nor some of the competence that he needs to demonstrate in order to be successful. And we need for him to be successful. Our nation needs for him to be successful. It doesn't matter whether you're Republican or Democrat. We need for our president, the world needs our president to be successful. He also recently has not demonstrated that he understands the character of this nation. I think our president needs to take stock of the role that he plays in our nation and move beyond himself, move way beyond himself, and move to a place where daily he's waking up thinking about what is best for our nation.
I played those out a little bit, Jim. Other than Lindsey Graham, that's about the strongest.
I would say that's the strongest.
Tougher.
That's even tougher.
Yeah.
To say that a president of the United States doesn't understand the character of his nation, I don't think I've ever heard a Republican or Democrat say that of a president. And basically what he's saying is it's almost going to take something akin to a religious conversion for Donald Trump to catch hold of that.
Yeah. And, you know, we have historically, I think Howard Baker is probably a great example of members of the Senate that from time have made statements to presidents of the United States where they had to, you know, hear another voice sort of shake them. And, you know, Lindsey Graham ran for president against President Trump. And, you know, they've, you know, President Trump's tweeted about Lindsey Graham, you know, when he made his comments. Bob Corker was someone who was considered to be vice president, was considered to be Secretary of State. President Trump hasn't tweeted today about Bob Corker.
And Corker, highly respected on the Hill, chair of the Foreign Relations Committee.
And so maybe, and I'm hopeful, that maybe the president heard what Bob Corker had to say.
Yeah. And then the Corker, right behind that, followed that when he said, you know, after he said the president has to find a way to move beyond himself. Right, and he has to do what's best for the nation.
Yeah,
and
you know,
it's not him.
I thought, right? I keyed in on that too. Yeah. Move beyond himself.
Yes. Look, folks, I don't want to be Debbie Downer or overly cynical, but we're talking about a 70-plus-year-old person,
and I'm 71.
Mm-hmm. I'm not there yet, but I'm headed there. I hope we all are actually. Who has no impulse control, who has no moral center, no moral compass, and who, in my mind, ran for president completely as an act of self-aggrandizement. And the good of the country, the character of the country, these are concepts that are foreign to him.
I didn't use the phrase religious conversion lightly.
I know, but I would love to see him change, because chaos is exactly the word that describes what we've been through since he was inaugurated. And I keep going back to one of the Republican debates where Jeb Bush actually used that phrase, Donald Trump is a chaos candidate. And when he said it, I thought, yeah, but what do you mean? And now, having lived through this for 7 or 8 months, I know exactly what he means. And I'd love to, if the guy could change. I just don't see it happening.
Eric, you are very in touch with a great many Republican leaders out there. You've been, you're highly thought of among Republicans. You talk to Mitt Romney's, the Bush families of the world. I'm not asking whether you've talked to them recently about what's happening with the president, but in a broader way. Where's the party headed with President Trump? I've maintained since they lost the health care vote that Trump was beginning to put himself in a position where he could find himself with primary opposition in 2020. And in the weeks since then, it's appeared increasingly possible that that may, in fact, if he doesn't change, develop.
Well, it's possible. I think that Republicans are unsettled. I think Bannon leaving the White House will cause further chaos in some circles. In some circles, there may be comfort by that. I do think that the president, and I said this throughout the campaign, the general election campaign, the president was a vessel for these people in America that felt disconnected from their government. Now he's the president. And I think there are a lot of people looking to him to do certain things. And I think the healthcare debate and the fact that the Senate was not able to pass a repeal and replace of Obamacare was a big disappointment to people in our party. We have been fighting for this and talking about this for 7 years. And now to have control of the House, control of the Senate, and a president in the White House and not be able to do that, that was a big disappointment. Tax reform. The Republican Party is committed, and I think there are Democrats that are committed to this too, but for tax reform. And I think that when the Congress reconvenes in September, there's going to be a big push for tax reform. I think there may be some that revisit. I think there'll be an effort to do something on the health care front. And I think time is going to determine what happens with the Republican Party. I'm not throwing in the towel. I think that the president was new at this. He's never held elective office. He came out of the business world. A lot of times business people think government is just like business. It's very different. Probably the biggest difference, and I heard a CEO say this the other day, that served in government, that the difference is that in business, you can make decisions and make them fast, but in government, it's about consensus and building consensus. And that's just something that Donald Trump's never had experience in. And maybe some of the last several months and what's happened with Obamacare, what's happened inside the White House, maybe the president will rise to the occasion. I'm still hopeful that that can happen. I think the country's bigger than just one individual. And I think that, you know, there's going to be a lot of pressure around the president to step up to the plate. And I'm still hopeful that he'll do it.
You know, so, Michael, I'll start with you on this, but you're all welcome to weigh in. I thought it was fascinating that while Corker and Tim Scott were being openly critical of President Trump for his conduct this past week, Paul Ryan, across the way in the House, was trying to refocus, desperately trying to refocus the message on, oh, we got big plans for tax reform and this and that. And it just seemed so, I mean, yes, it's true. Everybody wants to see some activity by this Congress, but it just seemed so weak to try to get that message out this week.
You know, I am so disheartened by this, but I can't say that at all. I'm surprised, because even Eric, some of the things you mentioned before, right, and some of the things that could have been positive that Trump ran on and potentially run on, we still want to talk about, you know, the Rust Belt, the coal miners, right, the people that were left behind, bringing jobs back, you know, all those things that building out our infrastructure, you know, those things that really could have been concrete to help this country forward. The things that's really permeated this entire presidency thus far has been the other things, the Muslim ban, right? The xenophobic type things he brought to the table. Muslim ban too, right? The emboldening the voice of neo-Nazis and the Klan. And these are things, quite honestly, that the administration and Congress and everyone else has had to put up with. Right. And the fleeting things when it comes to like health care and any other things that may have been tried, it turns into a drop in the bucket, a failure, but a drop in the bucket at that, because this administration has been nothing but dictated by those other messages that he ran on that's led the way.
Jim, and the problem now is that you're running out of your electives, if you'll enjoy that, if you'll accept the college metaphor. Now you've got your mandatory classes here. You've got the debt ceiling coming up. You've got the budget coming up. You've got an October deadline in which you've got all these indigent payments to hospitals, especially in Georgia, that are going to expire. You've got a children's health bill out there that needs work, or you've got a lot of kids who are going to go without medical care. You've got your list of things that you have to do. Your must-do list is growing longer and longer.
And if you're a Republican in the Senate, particularly if you're Mitch McConnell or Paul Ryan, you realize you're pretty much on your own. You don't have a national leader in the White House that can help you. If anything, he's been more of a hindrance to the Republican agenda.
Well, that doesn't mean you throw in the towel.
No, I'm not saying you throw in the towel. I'm just saying it complicates it for them, because they're pretty much, they have to do it themselves. You've still got the numbers, so.
Well, and look,
it's not like you won't get things done, but it would be easier if you had a stable, mature presence, politically astute presence in the White House, helping to lead that.
Can the president go out and do a roadshow on any of these things you want to get done, and actually do it in a coherent manner that's going to woo the American
public?
Point
well taken. And it becomes more and more difficult when you see some of the things that have been done. However, I'm still optimistic that we have leaders like Bob Corker, like Paul Ryan, like Mitch McConnell, and a number of Johnny Isaacson, David Perdue. I think there are a number of people, including a good number of people in the president's cabinet, Sonny Perdue being one of them. Look at what happened with NAFTA. You know, the president was ready to just throw out NAFTA. And I think our former governor had something to do with getting him to come back to the table. And so I still think we have other leaders in the Republican Party that are still engaged in the process. And we have someone who was elected president who wants to do a good job. Donald Trump, you know, prides himself on being a winner.
I want to change subjects in a second, but you Tuesday, if the schedule holds, and the mayor of Phoenix has asked him not to come, the president is going to do a rally in Arizona. And I think he has one the next day, and I frankly don't remember what state he's headed to after that. But I think there are two in a row. I think it's going to be fascinating to what is his speech going to be. Is it going to be recounting his victory? Is it going to be going after Hillary Clinton? Or is he going to begin to turn the ship that Eric says takes a long time to turn
around?
Or
is he going to do what has been rumored, which is to pardon Sheriff
Arpaio, right,
which just once again throws more kerosene on the flames that he lit this week.
But to Eric's point is, if if this presidency can be salvaged, it's going to be salvaged by members of Congress. And I think what you're going to see, and if you're a young person in the audience, mark it down. Mark it down. This could be a very important shift in in U.S. political power. From the executive branch to the congressional branch.
Yeah, we already saw the Senate. We did see Mitch McConnell. One of the reasons the president's so angry at him is that Mitch McConnell said to the president, no, we don't. Sorry, Mr. President. Yes, you want us to go back to health care again. We're moving on. So there's already been a beginning of that. We'll see. I want to do something else, though, if I can, and close out this conversation about where the president stands in terms of his moral authority, in terms of the stature in which he has to deal with Congress if he wants to get things accomplished. Susan Breaux, at the funeral of her daughter the other day, made very eloquent remarks. We played a couple minutes of them. And one of the things that was striking about him was that she said, we have to listen even to the people who she said maybe are nationalists, even though I don't agree with their agenda. People have to be heard. We have to understand. And it was a remarkable speech. Today on Good Morning America, she went in a somewhat different direction. And I think it's really troubling in terms of where it puts President Trump. The president apparently tried to call her several times. She didn't get back to him because she was busy, she said.
She was at her daughter's funeral.
She was at the funeral and then came home from the funeral, she said, and was exhausted and just didn't want to do it. But she had intended to call him. But this is how the conversation on GMA proceeded this morning.
So I hadn't really watched the news until last night. And I'm not talking to the president now. I'm sorry. What he said about my child. And it's not that I saw somebody else's tweets about him. I saw an actual clip of him at a press conference equating the protesters like Ms. Heyer with the KKK and the white supremacists.
And that is where you are right now, because after his statement, after he read his statement on Monday, you thanked him. But now you've had a chance to hear his remarks from Tuesday, and that has changed your position as far as the president is concerned and wanting to hear from him.
Absolutely. You can't wash this one away by shaking my hand and saying I'm sorry.
Is there something, though, that
I'm not forgiving for that.
I'm not finished.
Is there something, though, that you would want to say to the president?
Think before you speak.
I do have to say, Jim, I think Ms. Boss may have misheard some. The president did not, in fact, invoke her daughter's name in talking about the counter-protesters. So that's worth mentioning. But the larger point stands.
Yeah, and, who's going to argue with a mom who's lost her kid?
Yeah.
I think back to Presidents Reagan, George H.W. Bush, George Bush, people that were not exactly high on my list of people that I cared for in politics. But whenever we endured some type of national tragedy, every one of them, in his own way, was eloquent and heartfelt, and you knew he had a heart, and you knew he was compassionate. Certainly, I think we were spoiled. I was spoiled by Barack Obama, who I think has been one of the more eloquent presidents we've had in a long time. But we're used to a norm of a president that's in touch with his own moral, that has a moral center that he's in touch with, and who's able to speak for all of us. And what we're dealing with now is somebody who just can't fulfill that. I don't think he's personally capable of fulfilling that. And that's just it adds to the chaos around his presidency.
All right, it's been a very, very difficult week for many, many people, and let me ask one last question before we take a break, Jim, because this comes back at me. I think about this over and over as I try to figure out the right way to approach hosting this show. On a week like this, when there seems to be almost universal criticism of the way that, in this case, that President Trump conducted himself, how do we as journalists, who really do try to be balanced and fair-minded, it's almost impossible to find a middle ground where you can say, well, but on the other hand, it's very troubling.
What was the line from Winston Churchill? Don't ask me to stand between the fire and the fire brigade.
Yeah. Mm. Okay. Mm. I just think about that a lot. Does it make sense to the rest of you?
It makes sense. But you know,
well, you're also citizens. You have feelings, too.
Well, yeah, but the goal is to be as balanced as possible. Sure. But the president, in cases like this, makes it what is the balance?
Well, because this isn't a discussion over health care or trickle-down economics. You know, this is the heart and the core of America, right? And our makeup as a people. And when you cannot disassociate your voters, right, from your core sense of value as a person and value in humanity, and the idea of discrimination and those who would wish ill will on people simply because of who they are, who they were born as, and you cannot come to a center point with that and express compassion and understanding. And it was clear that when he read that statement, that's what he was doing. He was reading a statement. And then in the additional, or the next one after that, he was speaking. It was him.
All right.
So people wonder how he backtracked because that was him.
All right. You get the last word in this segment. Let's put I'd like to, in many ways, put this issue to rest for this week and hope for better next week. This is Political Rewind. Let's take a break.
A driver plows into a crowd in Barcelona. ISIS claims responsibility for the deadly attack.
The United States stands ready to assist the people of Spain and find and punish those responsible.
I'm Kelly McEvers. The latest from Barcelona, plus our weekly commentators on the political fallout from Charlottesville. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered is this afternoon from 4 till 7 on GPB.
Jim Galloway, so far in this show, we've talked about some of the dilemmas the Republicans face in terms of what happened this past week, but it hasn't been all beer and roses for the Democrats either, since Stacey Abrams said, as a candidate for governor, we ought to tear down the carvings of the Confederate leaders at Stone Mountain. You wrote a very eloquent column. And, of course, the larger conversation going on here and across the country about Confederate monuments. You wrote a very eloquent piece about that this week.
Thank you. I mean, it was number one. We've always edited the history in our public spaces. Always. I mean, the example I led off with was in 1776 in New York, the Declaration of Independence was read, and New Yorkers immediately marched to a park in Manhattan and tore down King George III's statue. Of course, then the British came and took New York, and, you know, that was a little bit awkward. But you've got the thing, you know, I was at a Wednesday press conference where Andy Young and C.T. Vivian were endorsing Caesar Mitchell for mayor of Atlanta. All right. And after that, I was asking Caesar Mitchell where he was on the changing of the Confederate Avenue. It's a street in the Grant Park neighborhood. And what he did was he held up both his hands and he laced his fingers together. And he says, our history is just so darned entwined and entangled in the South. You have to be really careful in how you unwind it. And it's not something that can be done from the street. It's not something that can be done in the din of protest. That it's got to be a very careful, calibrated decision. And I think that's where the older, more established Democrats are in Georgia.
You know, I grew up in Richmond, Virginia, where they were still fighting the War of Northern Aggression, as it was called up there, when I was growing up. And we actually have a major street in the city, Monument Avenue, which features at different circles each one of the folks that's in Stone Mountain and a few others. I understand, having grown up in that, I understand the pull that some people have to celebrating this history. But I also think you have to look at the history of how a lot of these monuments came to be erected and the period of time, the late 1890s, the early 1900s, when this was a project of the United Daughters of the Confederacy to try to retell the story of the Civil War, that it was a lost cause, and build this this romantic story around it, and to not just downplay, but to ignore the fact that it was about slavery as much as it was anything.
Well, I mean, yeah, the carving at Stone Mountain was really finished during the period between from 1950 into the early 1970s. That was a statement on segregation and integration.
And I think Stone Mountain is different. We'll talk about that in a minute, because that you're talking about a carving and a big slab of granite. But when you talk about these monuments, I think it's a conversation to be had about where is it appropriate to have them. I don't like people in Durham just going and tearing down monuments. I don't think that people who are upset about the monuments. I think that's a visceral reaction, and I just don't respond well to behavior like that. But I do think that we have museums, we have history centers, we have places that are appropriate to honor the leaders of the Confederacy and to tell the full story of who they were and what this war was about. And I think that, I look for cooler heads to prevail and help help guide us through. Sheffield Hale at the Atlanta History Center, by the way, is doing a great job.
He's
a thought
got it
leader.
Figured out. Yeah. I want to get both Eric and Michael into the conversation. If I could, Eric, just because you mentioned it at the start of the show, you were there when Governor Perdue, Roy Barnes went through this extraordinarily difficult process of changing, getting rid of the battle emblem from the Georgia flag. It was one of the things, it's overstated how much it meant to his losing the election, but it certainly was a factor. And then Governor Perdue, to some extent, ran on a promise that he would change that back again. But even he ran into issues with how to do that so that it wasn't offensive to the people who wanted it changed in the first place.
Well, let me just clarify. What Governor Perdue said is he wanted the people
a
to
referendum.
Have
I apologize.
A voice.
You're
and
right.
that was the problem with Governor Barnes. He rammed through something without giving people a voice. And I think sometimes policymakers react to things and act quickly without allowing for proper discussion and debate. And there were people in the terms of the flag that had very strong feelings on various sides of the issue. And so there was an opportunity to vote. And I think once we had the vote, obviously those that didn't support the current flag were disappointed, but the voters had a chance to express their views. Also with that, if you remember, there was a tour that Governor Perdue did around the country, around the state, a racial reconciliation tour. And I remember participating with Andy Young and Jimmy Carter, but to have a dialogue about race. And let's talk about the, elephant in the room that was stirred up during this flag debate. And going back to the monuments, though, the one thing I think is really important is that we need to remember that you can't change history. And the good, the bad, and the ugly. And I was mentioning earlier, and I suggest everyone read Peggy Noonan's column this week in the Wall Street Journal, but she makes a very strong point about young children. And when you show young children monuments that represent parts of history, the good, the bad, and the ugly, it's an opportunity to teach those kids. And if we just tear down monuments and get rid of them and try and erase even the dark parts of our history, I don't know that that helps us as a country as we move forward.
Yeah. Michael?
I agree with you, Eric, on that. I think the biggest thing I look at is there's a difference. There's a clear difference between celebrating and remembering, right? And I think, someone mentioned me the other day, and I was thinking about it. I said, it's all kind of in perspective, because if you talk about tearing down certain Confederate monuments, you look and see who rushes to stop that, right? And in this past case in Charlottesville, it was very clear the people we had to come to stop that. They were neo-Nazis. They were KKK members. They were not coming there in a pleasant way to remember history as someone with the Daughters of the Confederates or someone like that would be. So you have to put it in perspective of what that really looks like. But as far as history goes, you're talking about, you know, the end of slavery, you know, the beginning of industrialization. I think it's important to tell part of that story because it is. I would not want it to go away and we not have any insight and our next generation wouldn't understand what happened. It was important.
I'm sorry. Let me ask you a really practical question, though, Michael. You're an emerging African-American leader in the Georgia Democratic Party as chair of the Cobb County Party. And now Stacey Evans and Stacey Abrams Abrams has decided to put the Stone Mountain injected into the gubernatorial race.
Yes.
What is this going to do as your party tries to figure out who you're going to nominate?
I think that both of them kind of took a little divergent tactics with this, right? I think Evans had spoke about depicting history accurately, and I'm not exactly sure where she was going with that, but it is going to be a telling point as we go forward because, again, you want to recognize the history and understand it, but you have to put it in the context of what this was, right? And the Confederacy basically being, you know, treasonous people.
Yeah, but I'm talking about Abrams, the African-American candidate, and Evans, the white candidate.
It makes it tough. And we, you know, as a party, we've known from day one, right, between Evans and Abrams, the differences that lie there amongst them as individuals, but we also understand the party at large and society at large and where they're going to go. And we have our top two females who happen to be of opposite race, right, who are now challenging each other. The challenge we have is to make sure it does not become simply about who's black and who's white as to who we're going to support.
I think what you're going to see, Bill, is a generational gap. Among Democrats, because you have Michael Thurman, who's the DeKalb County CEO. He is taking Stacey Evans's position, not Stacey Abrams. He's not advocating removal of the carvings. Significantly, Hank Johnson, who is a backer of Stacey Abrams, he likewise says that that carving should not be removed. He further says that you shouldn't remove the Confederate statuaries from the U.S. Capitol.
You know, I think it just goes to show that we're going to have a divergence of opinion. We're not going to have a black leader or two or three black leaders who say, okay, here's what we do, and it's all settled. I think that that we have we just have to kind of work our way through this, listen to each other, talk to each other. My hope is that we don't have people that are just jumping off one end or the other. I was thinking about what Representative Abrams called for this week, and I was thinking that when you're introducing yourself to the electorate. To me, if I'm advising a candidate who's running statewide or running for any office, I think I'm wanting to lead with my biography, who I am,
sure.
Particularly with Stacey Abrams. But both Staceys have very impressive up from the bootstraps histories, and I would hope that for Representative Abrams' sake that she would come back into that lane because I think it's an impressive story that. That I'd like for people to hear about her before they're hearing about positions on different issues.
I've got to interrupt you because we're really running out of time, but I promised at the start of the show we'd at least mention the Plant Vogel situation. There was a bit of bill in Congress, real quick, to explain this, Jim. An $800 million tax credit for Plant Vogel's expansion, if for any facility that's online by 2021. Well, Vogel won't be online till 2023. There's been an effort in the House. They passed an amendment to that, which would extend that deadline. The Senate is locked up on it because they want to deal with the tax reforms instead. It puts them in a real bind in Georgia.
It does, and it's even more important because this is the only nuclear project now under construction in the United States.
Meanwhile, if you can get past the paywall of the Wall Street Journal, PSC Commissioner Tim Echols wrote an op-ed piece today saying he's now firmly in the camp of those who believe they should go ahead, find a way to finish the expansion of Vogel. The headline is "Diversifying the Energy Supply Makes Sense Because No One Knows What the Future Holds," says our friend Tim Echols. Interesting.
Well, there's a populist issue in all this in terms of who's paying for it.
Yeah.
Because the ratepayers have been paying for it. It's never become a major issue in PSC contest. But given how turned up people are these days, it could well become an issue in upcoming PSC races.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about that on this show, and we will continue to talk about it because it's really, you're quite right, it's going to affect a lot of people in the pocketbook, we imagine. Yeah. All right, we are, I'm sorry to say, out of time first. You know, I talked about the dilemma of how you balance with Trump. When you all come in here with so much good stuff to say, it's so hard for me to try to cut you off because I want to keep listening. So we never get quite as many things done as I hope we will. But thank you all for Michael Owens, Eric Tannenblatt, Beth Shapiro, and Jim Galloway for a really smart conversation again today. I appreciate your being here. Just a few notes before we leave you. The bright light, the brilliance of our sun here at Political Rewind is going to be eclipsed by NPR's eclipse coverage on Monday afternoon. So we are not going to be here at 2 o'clock on Monday. Instead, you'll hear NPR's expanded coverage of the eclipse, which is probably, and I'm told that they're going to have correspondents up in Northeast Georgia around Clayton, where the eclipse is going to be total. So you may want to check out their coverage on Monday afternoon. We're back here on Wednesday. And on Wednesday, we're going to talk to Jeff Flake. Senator Jeff Flake will be telling us about his book, Conscience of a Conservative. And I presume talking to us about what it's like to have the President of the United States tweet his support for your Republican, one of your potential Republican primary opponents. That should really be interesting, Galloway.
Well, it'll depend on what happens Tuesday in Arizona, too.
Tell me, what does that mean?
The president is going to be in Arizona. Yeah. Right. I think he's likely to go after Flake.
I think that's probably very true. So, come on back to Wednesday at 2 o'clock. My thanks as the week comes to an end to our engineer, Tyler Morris, to our associate producer, Olivia Rheingold, and to our senior producer, Jenny Amond, who, by the way, during the show, tweeted to me that there is a bar in Washington, D.C., that has just announced it is offering free drinks every time Trump fires someone in the administration. We appreciate that little note, Jenny. Thank you very much for that. So that's it for us. I'm Bill Nygut. Come back and join us again on Wednesday. And if you're going to be up there in Northeast Georgia, enjoy the blackness at 2:30 in the afternoon. Have a great weekend, everybody.